You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, demand for coronavirus testing is skyrocketing, and that's caused a shortage of the different components that go into those tests. We'll talk about new reporting from WisConText that looks at how labs and hospitals in Wisconsin are filling the gaps. First, the coronavirus has changed the way we work, the way we socialize, the way we keep in touch with family, and the way we travel or not travel. How about the way we eat? With school closures, stay-at-home orders, and disrupted routines, it can be hard to keep up healthy eating habits. But our next guest has some advice. Beth Olson is an associate professor and extension specialist with UW-Madison Nutritional Sciences Department. She has some suggestions for healthy eating practices while a lot of us are following Governor Evers' safer-at-home order. Beth, welcome back to Central Time.
I'm happy I could be here, if just virtually.
Now, Beth, the bad news first, there is not one magical ingredient or nutrient or diet that's a surefire way to stop viruses, right?
Right. The way we are telling people to eat is the same way we've been telling them to eat all along, the same recommendations, general overall healthy diets as best that you can, given your situation. So lots of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, make sure to get protein, and then our dairy group or something equivalent. And I would say if you're reading online about taking certain nutrients in high quantities, that's not been proven to help you prevent getting the virus. And so I think I would save my money for nutritious foods and not worry about trying to take some kind of supplements.
And the good news there, Beth, is that the recommendations you just gave us are also good for our long-term heart health and brain health and so many other things. We're doing a lot of good stuff if we can keep up those healthy eating habits now, right?
Right. We can keep healthy habits going and carry them into the future. And instead, what we might want to think about is, do we have to change how we achieve those healthy objectives at all? So some of us aren't getting to the grocery store as often. We may not have as much fresh fruits and vegetables on hand. So now's the time to think about how would I use what I have in my freezer? How might I use what I have in my pantry? And when you're shopping, when you do go out, take a look when you're purchasing those items and pick the healthiest ones that you can find and afford. So maybe canned vegetables that don't have added sodium, or canned fruits without added sugar, or frozen fruits and vegetables.
Can you talk about planning our shopping trips a little bit? It seems like we're all trying to be a little more premeditated these days.
Yes, certainly planning these days would help so that you can get in and out of the store faster, so that you don't have to make unnecessary trips up and down the aisle. So you might get out your old cookbooks, or if you have the ability to get online and look up some recipes, plan your shopping list very carefully. Check what you already have on hand so you're not overbuying. And then make a list of things that you can buy. Maybe think about some alternatives. So if you get your heart set on a recipe that has fresh apples and it doesn't have it, think, well, could I substitute pears or something like that? Then make a good list out and take that with you to the store. Another thing I've suggested to folks is this might be a time when you have kids at home that you didn't before, and perhaps they'd like to help you in planning the meals. It's always been shown that kids eat better, more healthy when they have a say in what's being put on the table. So have them help you look things up online or look in cookbooks. Maybe have them write the grocery list to practice their writing. Make calculations. You can make it an experience you can do together and something that's good for their learning as well.
I've heard from some people over the years, Beth, those frozen or canned veggies you mentioned, some people kind of look down on those, worry that they're not getting the nutrients they'd get from the fresh stuff. It's still worth eating those, it sounds like?
Oh, definitely. Often things that are canned or frozen, it happens right out of the field, and it preserves the nutrients very well. As I said earlier, I think your main concern is where you can pick things that don't have added sugar or sodium. There's some packaged frozen vegetables that have added sauces. Avoid those if you can. They have a lot of saturated fat. So try for the simplest canned and frozen produce that you can find.
We're talking to Beth Olson, associate professor and extension specialist at Madison Nutritional Sciences Department. She's giving us some healthy eating advice for a time of coronavirus, school closures, and stay-at-home orders. Beth, with the routines disrupted, a lot of people are feeling more stress or anxiety right now. There's a temptation to eat more junk food. Can you give us some advice on how to resist?
Yes. Well, you know, I feel like this is one where we have to think about it both ways. One thing is you might want to try planning your meals and snacks ahead of time and then trying to stick with that. I know people are making schedules out for their children for school, for instance. So go ahead and plan your times for breakfast, lunch, dinner, plan some healthy snacks so that you aren't just tempted to drift over to the cupboard and pick out chips. Of course, when you're planning your grocery list, you can avoid some of those. On the other hand, I think we've got a lot of stress going on in our lives right now, and now isn't the time for us to be overly concerned that we mustn't do anything wrong with our nutrition. So I'd say a fun activity with your kids would be to bake some cookies. I think if you're going to watch a movie in the evening, having a little kind of movie night with popcorn would be fun. So I think we also have to think about how much enjoyment and comfort we get from our food and what the things that we can do with our food together, like prepping it. Maybe you want to set your table special every night or in a different way and sit down and eat together with your family. So we want to be healthy, but I don't think we need to stress so much. Nothing we're going to do in these next couple of months is going to make the biggest difference in our lives in terms of nutrition.
It could be an interesting time, though. We've talked in the past, Beth, about setting up good, healthy habits so we don't have a willpower test every day. We just habitually build good eating. That could be one of our projects during our time at home, trying to build in some kind of more nutritious eating or, as you say, build in that family time around a meal that we might not have been able to finagle before.
Oh, exactly. I think that starts right with the planning. Sometimes we just don't eat that well because we don't plan ahead. We don't have anything to make when we get home, so we go out to eat. So this would be a time to start to say, how do I plan my meals? Do I, you know, look up a recipe, write out the ingredients, shop for just what I need? Do I plan carefully not to to have healthy snacks instead of snacks that are tempting but less nutritious? And then again, you know, using it as a time to be together with your family and talk about something you haven't been able to talk about because you've been rushed before. Maybe a plan a family vacation that you want to do once this is settled down, or talk about the last family vacation you have and sit and enjoy your food. Eat slowly, turn the TV off while you're eating. You know, all the things that we've been talking about now might be, you might have a little bit more time to practice some of that.
And Beth, I know we're talking mostly about the quality of our food here, but for some people, quantity is a concern. Kids who are generally getting meals at school aren't. People may be laid off temporarily, hopefully only temporarily, but they can't afford food. A good time to seek out resources offered by schools and others, right?
Right. A lot of places are still offering the kind of meals that would have been provided to people who need them. They're just doing it in a different way. So people can call 211, or they can Google that with Wisconsin and find an online resource and find out where could they go with their children and pick up a grab-and-go lunch or maybe breakfast and lunch, where someone might be able to pick up meals for their senior who might have been going to a congregate meal program but no longer is. And a lot of food pantries, I think, are still operating. So instead of coming into the pantry, though, you might be driving up and picking up the food. So if anybody's having trouble getting food, they should look for online or call 211 and find those resources that can help them out. And then for some of us who are doing well, perhaps if we know we have an elderly neighbor, we check in and see whether we might buy them some groceries and, you know, leave them in their garage or on their front step or something to help someone else out.
Beth, we've gotten a lot of questions in the last few weeks about safety, the concern that we might be bringing viruses home on packaging and things like that. Is that something you're getting asked a lot in you and your colleagues in your department?
Indeed, we are. And people can check a couple of websites, the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, and CDC. Both have recommendations. You know, the biggest one still is wash your hands. Wash your hands, wash your preparation services or surfaces. So when you go and get groceries, you know, try not to be touching anything you don't have to. And then wash your hands as soon as you get home. Put away your groceries and then wash your hands again when you touch food containers, whether those be groceries or maybe if you pick up something to eat from a drive-through or something like that. Wash your hands after you touch the containers. There is just nothing out there right now to suggest that people have gotten the virus from foods or food containers. Remember, we eat the food. We don't breathe it in like we do the way that we usually think about getting the virus. I think that is about where FDA and CDC have come out. However, I do see other people at state level, for instance, recommending if people are really concerned, they can do a couple more things. One is when they rinse their fresh produce in water, they could dip it into a mixture of water and vinegar, a 50-50 mix for a minute, and then rinse it again with water. Don't use soap. Don't use bleach or Lysol. None of those things are good to eat. And another would be if you're very concerned when you bring your groceries into the house, you could wash off or wipe off with a disinfectant. The outside of cans, you could let your cardboard boxes of food sit in your pantry for a day or so before you touch them. And then again, as soon as you touch everything and before you eat, wash your hands.
Beth, thanks a lot for joining us again today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.
That's Beth Olson, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist with the UW-Madison Nutritional Sciences Department. We have some of the resources she mentioned, by the way, linked at the WPR.org Central Time page. And tomorrow morning on the morning show, Beth had mentioned substituting, using the ingredients you have in your pantry, freezer, and fridge from 6 to 7 on the morning show. They're going to give advice on cooking in just that way. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the shortage of supplies for coronavirus testing in Wisconsin and how that's impacting frontline healthcare workers. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump is calling for a $2 trillion infrastructure plan to be part of a future coronavirus stimulus package. We'll find out if the idea is getting any traction during our look at the week in Washington. First, the number of new coronavirus cases is growing here in Wisconsin, and so is demand for tests that can confirm the virus. But as the pandemic spreads around the world, there are big shortages for the components that go into those tests. A new piece from WisConText shows the different ways that hospitals and labs across the state are trying to keep up. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisConText. Will, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
What, Will, does testing capacity look like here in Wisconsin now compared to where we were at the start of this outbreak?
It's looking a lot better than it was at the beginning of the outbreak. I'm not sure if people remember at this point, but I guess it wasn't that long ago. Back in February, all tests conducted in Wisconsin and anywhere in the U.S. had to be sent to the CDC in Atlanta to be confirmed. That took quite a while and was a pretty limited basis. And even when testing was expanded to the public health labs in the state here, it was still quite limited, initially to 100 or so tests per day. But that capacity has been expanded greatly up to 1,500 or 2,000 test results per day at this point.
Who all is doing testing, is running these tests in labs right now in Wisconsin?
It's a real mix of the public health labs, so that would be the State Hygiene Lab in Madison, as well as the Milwaukee Health Department's lab. And then a whole bunch of private labs are assisting with the public health lab response. And what we're seeing now more and more is a number of private health systems have brought testing into their own systems. So it's really expanding a lot.
Okay, we've expanded our capacity for testing, Will. Are we now testing everybody the public health community wants to be testing?
That's a really good question. And I think the short answer is no. Both public health officials and healthcare workers and my understanding, the general public really wants testing to be expanded further. Right now, we're generally testing just kind of the cases that public health officials have identified as being high priority. That includes frontline healthcare workers if they're symptomatic, people who live or work in long-term care facilities like nursing homes, as well as patients who are hospitalized, so people with serious illness.
Let's look at some of the roadblocks you write about in your piece at WisContext, Will. One of them was the person power, the researchers in labs. That sounds like, from what you were saying, that part of the puzzle has expanded a lot by bringing more labs on board.
It has, yeah. I think basically health systems have been allowed to develop their own tests if they want by the federal government. And a number of local health systems in the state have taken that up and have developed their own tests. So they themselves have created tests using the CDC's tests as a guideline, as well as old tests for the original SARS virus, which is genetically similar to this current virus, coronavirus, as a roadmap for developing their own tests. And they've really done so with pretty great speed. Usually it takes months and months to develop a test like this that can identify a virus. But we have seen health systems develop their own tests within a month.
That's pretty impressive. And a big point here, this is a novel coronavirus, this exact virus we haven't seen before. So it sounds like it's easier said than done to come up with my own test to detect it.
Totally, yeah. Much easier said than done. There were some clues, I guess, based on the original SARS virus, which emerged in the 2000s and the tests that were available for that. But yeah, it's really quite a feat.
Will Cushman is with us, associate editor of WisContext. He recently wrote about the challenges of providing enough testing for coronavirus here in Wisconsin and everywhere, more or less. Now, Will, let's talk about the gear that's needed to test. Are these different hospitals and agencies able to get a hold of the stuff they need to do these tests?
That's really the primary challenge to being able to expand testing further. From what I talked to people at the State Hygiene Lab, at Mayo Clinic, which has developed its own tests, as well as a whole bunch of other folks who are involved in this, and they all say that really the main limiting factor in testing right now and what is keeping the state of Wisconsin and healthcare systems and just the nation as a whole from testing as many people as they would like to, including people with maybe moderate or mild symptoms, is this really severe shortage of pretty much every single material that is required to test. So that includes the swabs that are needed to take a test or to collect a specimen. Those swabs are called nasopharyngeal swabs. They're these really long, flexible swabs. Anyone who's gotten an influenza test is probably familiar with it. They're really uncomfortable when you're getting the specimen taken. Basically, the healthcare worker has to stick this really long rod up your nose to reach your nasopharynx, which is way up in your upper respiratory system. Those swabs are in severe, there's a severe shortage of those swabs, as well as pretty much all of the components that are needed for analyzing a specimen. Those are called reagents. That's basically a fancy word for something that can catalyze a chemical reaction. And so a whole bunch of those are needed for analyzing a specimen in order to identify whether or not the virus is present in it. And all of that is short as well. Another thing that people everywhere are short on is something called viral transport media. That is the liquid that the specimens need to sit in while they're being transported to a lab for analysis. That is also in severely short supply.
Ironically, you need to keep the virus alive at this point so you can successfully test for it.
Right. And I guess scientists would debate whether or not the virus is alive, but definitely need to keep it,
viable, I guess.
Sure.
Now, you also wrote about Governor Evers assembling a partnership or strike team to tackle some of these issues. What's going on there?
Yeah, that was announced earlier this week, I believe on Monday. So Governor Evers is describing this as a public-private partnership. And the state government has enlisted a whole bunch of private health providers with a presence in the state. That includes the Marshfield Clinic and UW Health, as well as technology companies that I think a lot of people in the state would be familiar with. That would be Epic Systems, Exact Sciences, and Promega. And really the purpose of the strike team is to identify as many ways as possible to expand testing. The immediate goal is to double the capacity of testing in the state. And then the eventual goal is to make testing for COVID-19 more akin to testing for influenza in the state, where it's basically available on demand by doctors.
Will, we're looking to expand capacity to test. Are there also efforts to speed things up so we turn around those results faster and people know if they really have to quarantine and isolate right away?
Right. Those two things kind of go hand in hand. What basically how the testing system has evolved over the last month or so it's created a more diffuse testing system. So as I mentioned earlier, it originally was all being done through the CDC at its headquarters in Atlanta, and then it was being done at just a select few labs in the state, and now it's really becoming much more diffuse. There are much more labs at hospitals that are able to provide results for tests, and that is really what healthcare providers and public health officials really want. Because in addition to just expanding capacity, testing more people, you're reducing the turnaround time from when you take a specimen to when you get results. And that can have a lot of public health benefits as well. If people know that they're positive or negative for COVID-19, they can act on that more quickly.
And as we wrap up briefly, Will, what are you watching for next?
Ooh, what I'm watching for next, I am really interested in a couple things. One is I'm going to be looking at volunteer medical corps in the state to see if they're going to be involved in responding to COVID-19. And we're also going to be looking at, as I think a lot of other people are, whether or not face masks are still going to be not recommended for the vast majority of people right now.
Will, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
That's Will Cushman, associate editor of WIS Context. He was with us today to talk about his latest story on the shortage of coronavirus testing supplies in Wisconsin and nationally. You can find that story at wiscontext.org. And tune into Central Time tomorrow at 3:30. We'll talk to one of the physicians who helped Mayo Clinic develop their own coronavirus tests. Coming up after the news, negotiations on another emergency spending package are already underway in Congress. We'll find out about an infrastructure plan President Trump wants to see in that bill if it emerges. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the federal government is gearing up to send out trillions of dollars in aid to Americans and businesses impacted by the coronavirus. Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin joins the show to talk about what's in the package and what comes next. First, we're taking a look at the week in national politics. President Trump is calling for a major infrastructure plan to be part of a future coronavirus relief package, saying that Congress should go big and bold. He's also extending the government's social distancing recommendations until April 30th. And in a press conference last week, Trump criticized Democratic governors, some of them for not showing appreciation for receiving federal assistance. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of how the president has responded to the COVID-19 pandemic? What do you want to see him and members of Congress push for in the next stimulus package? Is now a good time to lock down an infrastructure plan? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Seungmin Kim is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Seungmin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with something you've been reporting on, this suggestion from the president on Twitter for an infrastructure plan, a big one, to be part of a future stimulus package. He said $2 trillion. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she's hoping for $760 million for infrastructure over 5 years. What's going on there?
So Infrastructure Week actually has been kind of a running joke in Washington
right.
for some time now. Whenever something kind of goes awry with the Trump administration, we always kind of joke that it's Infrastructure Week. But there could actually be discussion this time while the administration and Capitol Hill really scramble to find ways to stimulate the economy beyond that $2.2 trillion package that we saw signed into law last week. The president always hasn't really had these deficit concerns. So he puts out a big number $2 trillion. And this is something that he told privately to allies that he wants to do at some point. Nancy Pelosi obviously wants to put her own stamp on the legislation by proposing a Democratic kind of starting point, starting line in terms of what they want to see in their infrastructure proposal. But it's really important to remember that we're in the very, very early stages here. And you're going to need sign off from congressional Republicans, particularly Senate Republicans, which controls that chamber. And if you listen to the words of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, he is taking a very kind of wait and see approach on what we would call a phase four of a coronavirus package in Congress. He wants to let this massive $2.2 trillion package work and see and kind of go from there and assess and gauge the impact before deciding to do anything else.
Right. And the impact of that is, you know, it hasn't even really started to trickle out that money yet, right, from the phase three?
Exactly. I mean, the benefit that the most Americans will probably see and the most kind of visual signal or sign or emblem of this package are those checks totaling up to $1,200 per person that will go out if you meet a certain income threshold. But those checks aren't going to go out for at least a few weeks. So it's going to be some time. And, you know, today is April 1st. There are rents due, there are bills due, and there are mortgages due. So this really doesn't provide immediate relief. I mean, federal government is working as fast as they can, but those checks aren't going to go out right away. Some of the more complicated parts of this measure are also the expanded unemployment benefits. While that is something that is supported by both Democrats and Republicans, we have to remember each state has their own kind of unemployment benefits application system. So that's another complicated process. So while in Congress's terms, they moved actually relatively quickly in passing this package, it will be some time before we see the average American who qualifies for aid under this package can actually see those benefits in their hands, in their pockets.
With the infrastructure idea, you report that some people have raised concerns. You know, right now we're trying to social distance and keep some people away from work. New infrastructure spending would theoretically bring groups of people together to do work. Is that a roadblock here?
I mean, a nice pun there with roadblock. I think that would be one concern. But remember, Congress is actually out and they won't be convening again at the earliest April 20th. And I think considering all the stay-at-home orders that we've been seeing, particularly here in the Washington area, April 12th could perhaps even be an ambitious date. So I think at that point, whenever Congress reconvenes, there will be some sort of we will have a little bit of better guidance as to whether these social distancing guidelines are relaxed a little bit or, you know, extended even further. But that is a concern. I mean, one thing that's been mentioned a lot recently is that there is so much of COVID-19 that we're still learning. We're learning how it transmits. We're learning that, you know, you don't necessarily have to be showing symptoms to have this virus. We're learning about how long this virus stays alive in the air and on surfaces. So I think, you know, if and when the Congress and the administration discuss, a phase four package, I think that's also something that they're going to have to think about.
Now, staying with phase three for a moment, you and some of your colleagues wrote up the kind of frantic efforts to hammer this thing out. As you mentioned, infrastructure we've been talking about for years, immigration we've been talking about for decades. But in this crisis here, Congress did a really big thing really fast. What stood out to you about some of the behind the scenes maneuvering?
I think you're exactly right. But the fact that Congress was able to move at such relative speed to get at this package so quickly. And I recall just at the start of these negotiations back in about mid-March when senior administration officials started tossing around a $1 trillion figure. Our eyes were popping at how massive that package was. But that number quickly ballooned to $2.2 trillion pretty quickly without, without Democrats or Republicans even really batting an eye here. And what stood out to me, too, was that there's always, even in a time even in a time of crisis, there always is going to be very much internal tension. Democrats were so angry at Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell because he kind of went, he did not want to negotiate with Speaker Nancy Pelosi. His view was that the House had kind of taken the lead on the previous packages, and it was really time for Senate Republicans to start the process here. There were a lot of tense moments. There were tense phone calls. And it was also striking to me, we're used to it by now, but sometimes a tweet from the president can really get in the way of these negotiations. We report on a scene where Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin were in Schumer's Capitol office late at night. They were about to, you know, put the handshake deal on, and then Trump tweeted some pretty harsh comments about Nancy Pelosi. So Senator Schumer dialed up the president and said, look, those tweets do not help. I think the negotiators largely kind of kept the president out of the process, kind of followed the guidelines of what he would sign, but didn't really let the day-to-day tweeting and the rhetoric from the president kind of dictate the negotiation. So I thought that was an interesting point as well.
Talking to Seungmin Kim from The Washington Post. It's our weekly roundup of the latest news in national politics. Well, that's the president and Congress. There's also been a combination of tension and cooperation between the White House and governors looking for federal help. Here's the president speaking late last week, talking about Vice President Mike Pence, the point person on coronavirus, Mike Pence's communication with state leaders.
He calls all the governors. I tell him, I mean, I'm a different type of person. I say, Mike, don't call the governor of Washington. You're wasting your time with him. Don't call the woman in Michigan. Well, it doesn't make any difference what happens.
The governor of Washington?
No, you know what I say? If they don't treat you right, I don't call. He's a different type of person. He'll call quietly anyway, okay?
So that's a unique message from a president in a time of crisis. What's been can you lay out some of the back and forth of the president and how he talks about and deals with governors?
Exactly. I think, first of all, governors know that even if they are the opposing party of the president or have tangled with President Trump in the past, they know that there does need to be some sort of federal state cooperation. So I think you saw at the outset, particularly from New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, trying to make nice with the president, kind of, kissing up to him on air, knowing that, again, he needs the federal assistance. But, you know, there is a patience limit for a lot of these politicians. And the president has really lashed out at a lot of these governors. I mean, one target that has one of its frequent targets during this pandemic has been Washington Governor Jay Inslee, where we know his home state was one of the first or the first that was really hard hit by this crisis. And early on in the process, he called Governor Inslee a snake in a private call with governors. Governor Inslee pushed back and said, you know, he didn't perhaps call the president names, but said, you know, we can't have just backup from these states. We need a Tom Brady, you know, referring to the now, you know, the former Patriots, now Buccaneers quarterback, in terms of the kind of guidance and the leadership they need from the federal administration. And we've seen him clearly tangle with a Michigan governor, Gretchen Whitmer, who, interestingly, Michigan, clearly an important state for the president to keep in his column this November. And Governor Whitmer, someone who was talked about for the party's vice presidential nomination. So he really does. I mean, there has been a tendency for the president in past natural disasters under his presidency to lash out at city and state officials that have been hit hard by natural disasters. I'm thinking about Puerto Rico officials as one example. So this is kind of playing out, that kind of dynamic is playing out again, except on just such a broader scale.
We're talking about President Trump's response to the COVID-19 pandemic and other top stories in national politics with Seungmin Kim, White House reporter for The Washington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think President Trump has done at addressing the pandemic? Do you worry about his rhetoric getting in the way of solutions? Do you see enough cooperation between states and the federal government? Do you want to see more efforts from the president and Congress when it comes to economic recovery, economic relief from the economic consequences of the coronavirus pandemic? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Soonmin Kim, White House reporter at The Washington Post, looking at some of the week's news from the nation's capital. Soonmin, as you said earlier, you know, Congress is out for a couple weeks now, at least. What are you watching for right now when it comes to federal responses to the coronavirus?
Well, first of all, I'm waiting to see whether all these pleas from particularly hospitals, medical professionals for just basic equipment are satisfied. We've heard so many stories about hospitals all over the nation being so short on these PPEs, these personal protective equipment, such as masks and just body coverings so they can administer tests, so they can administer, they can care for the people who are sick. That is a question that, you know, my colleagues and I have repeatedly pressed upon the president and the members of his task force at these briefings about when exactly are all those materials going to come down to these hospitals that need them. Ventilators are obviously another huge necessity. And what is the president doing to ramp up production of these? And at the end of the day, what is so crucial to watch for us in Washington and also to repeatedly ask the administration on are testing. I mean, it wasn't that long ago where the president, you know, falsely said that if anyone who wants a test can get a test. We clearly see that that is not true. Even people who need a test, who may have some of the symptoms, these tests kits have to be prioritized. For example, people who are showing severe symptoms or for symptomatic healthcare workers. The president's task force, particularly Vice President Mike Pence, if you watch these briefings, tout almost every day the rising number of tests that they are making available in the United States. And while that is true, there are more that are being made available. State officials, people on the ground, hospitals say that is clearly not enough. We are not testing enough per capita as other countries such as South Korea. And that is something that I'm going to be watching and something really critical for the American public to pay attention to in the coming weeks.
And that reminds me of a bit of ancient history, Soonmin, phase two of economic relief from Congress. I think that's the one, and it's been, what, 3 or 4 weeks or something now. That was the one that tried to aim funding for healthcare providers in particular, right? Is that money starting to translate into the stuff you were just talking about?
Healthcare providers, there were medical leave provisions that Congress focused on. And it's hard to see. I mean, you have heard some sort of positive responses, but it's, you know, when that money kind of gets tied up in the bureaucracy of the administration, I mean, it's hard to see right now how directly that money is benefiting these particular states. And also just remember the demand is just so overwhelming for these hospitals, for these medical providers right now. So whether that, you know, injection of emergency spending, which is about $100 billion, that second tranche of spending, you know, how much of that has gone into effect is a good question. It's something that we're also watching.
Talking to Soonmin Kim from The Washington Post, looking at some of the big stories in national politics, pretty much all coronavirus related these days. Soonmin Kim, another story you're following is at the State Department now, and a lot of members of Congress are very curious about this. The fate of Americans currently abroad trying to get back here to the United States among lockdowns, difficulties traveling by air, of course. What's the story there?
So obviously, at any given moment, there are hundreds, tens of thousands of Americans traveling abroad, whether for vacation, for work. And a lot of these travel advisories kind of came at a rapid clip. You know, we first saw the president talks about how he shut down a lot of the travel by non-U.S. citizens from China earlier on in this pandemic crisis. We saw the ban from Europe, and now the State Department is warning anybody not to travel abroad at this time, putting it at a level 4 travel advisory, which is the highest level, and urging all Americans to come home. That obviously creates a lot of logistical troubles. You have airlines that have cut, you know, up to 90-some-odd percent of their international flight capacities. A lot of Americans abroad are in remote places where it's just hard to, it just takes longer to get to an airport. And once, even when you get to that airport, just the trying to get a flight is limited. A lot of these Americans are appealing through their members of Congress, particularly senators, who are then, you know, appealing straight to the State Department. But in our reporting has shown that, you know, there have been some successes in getting, repatriating these Americans, making sure they're able to get home, chartering flights so that they are able to get back into the United States safely. There has been a lot of frustration from both Republicans and Democrats in the Senate about how expeditiously these Americans are being brought home. You know, we have, Senator Mark Warner, the Democrat from Virginia. He told us last week, and I want to caution this was last week so the numbers can be updated by now, but as of late last week, more than 100 of his constituents were stuck in Algeria, Kenya, Saudi Arabia, India, Samoa, Ghana, the Philippines, and Peru. Senator Marco Rubio, a Republican from Florida, was really frustrated at the State Department. You know, he is a Republican. He is an ally of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. But he complained that mid-level officials at the State Department really failed to act quickly to try and repatriate some of Florida residents who were stuck in Peru. So this is a process that, again, the administration has recognized is ongoing and are trying to do that. I thought it was notable that the president said yesterday, he noted that more than 25,000 Americans from more than 50 countries have been brought home. But this is something that senators from both parties are clearly going to continue to be pushing for.
Right. You report that senators from both parties aren't just frustrated about Americans not being able to get back home. Those senators themselves, it sounds like, have a hard time getting a phone meeting with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to even raise the issue. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So there were a lot of we didn't get specific complaints, perhaps about Pompeo directly from the senators, but you know there was frustration about miscommunication or the lack of communication from mid-level officials at the State Department, you know, Senator, or even just a lack of information. Senator Lisa Murkowski, who's a Republican from Alaska, told us that, you know, maybe it's not a lack of response from the State Department, but more a lack of specific information that is being funneled to their office or to her constituents who are stuck in these various countries. So there are senators have clearly identified some communication mishaps in the State Department where there are a lot. At a time when there are a lot of Americans who are just, I'm sure, frustrated and want to get home.
In our last minute and a half or so, Seungmin, you talked about what you're looking for next when it comes to the economic relief and some of the medical supply issues. This story is developing super fast. What else do you have your eye on right now?
I think another thing to have our eye on is, again, the impact on the elections. I mean, you talked earlier about the impact on Wisconsin's primary. A lot of states have clearly pushed back their primary voting calendar to June, whereas I believe the first Tuesday in June is almost becoming the second, you know, coronavirus-induced Super Tuesday of sorts. But we don't know how long this is going to last. You know, I live in Virginia, and we are under a stay-at-home order until June 10th, which is obviously a little longer than what the federal government is suggesting so far. But, you know, the calendar pushes further and further, and obviously it may have, you know, it may already be having an impact on the Democratic convention in Milwaukee. A few weeks later could also have an impact on the Republican National Convention. And, you know, what happens just with the logistics of having an election in November? You know, hopefully we'll be out of the worst at that point. But I think that is something that obviously, election officials at every level of government are closely watching and working on right now, and something that we are following as well.
Seungmin, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Seungmin Kim is a White House reporter at The Washington Post. She joined us for our weekly roundup of some of the top stories in national news, including President Trump's latest responses to the novel coronavirus, including the idea of an infrastructure package as part of the next stimulus bill from Congress, plus a look at the previous big economic recovery bill as that starts to spin out some money and some help for small businesses and others around the country. And for Wisconsin election news, keep following the breaking stories there over at WPR.org/news. It's April 1st, April Fool's Day. I didn't see a ton of April Fool's jokes online today, and that's mostly okay. But today is a for real national observation. It's National Census Day. And the Census Bureau is asking you to celebrate by filling out your census survey and then sending it back to them. They're not really very creative with the celebrations over at the Census Bureau. But here's a way that we at Central Time can keep the Census Party burning at full speed with another Central Time Census update. As I reported last week, according to the Census self-response map, Wisconsin had pulled ahead of Nebraska to take the lead as the number one census self-responding state in the country. As of the latest update this afternoon, Wisconsin is tied for first place with Minnesota. Our neighbors to the west crept up on us, and we are neck and neck at a 46.4 census self-response rate. That compares to a national average of 38%, so we're way ahead of the curve. This is a grudge match, by the way. Minnesota beat us by just 0.5% or so in 2010. Nebraska, Iowa, and Michigan right now round up the top five. We can still win this thing, but it's going to take some work. No fooling. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.